Springfield's Talk 104.1. I'm Nick Reed, and it's Thursday, which means it's Author of the Week time, sponsored by our good friends at ABC Books on North Glenstone. And we always love having in-studio authors, which usually means that there's probably going to be a book signing, and that does apply. We'll give you the details on that. James Owen, the author of The Wicked Among Us, Murder, Blackmail, and Book Collecting in the Ozarks. Thanks for being in here. You said you've actually been in this studio with Kyle Wyatt.
I have, yeah. I practiced law down in Southwest Missouri for a number of years. And in that capacity, I was able to come in here and talk to him about various issues and topics. And yeah, always got a kick out of that.
Yeah, he's entertaining.
Yes, he is.
So are you from the area? Because you're in Columbia now, correct? Is that right? Or just give us your background a bit, if you would.
I am in Columbia. I was born and raised in a little town called Elkland, Missouri, which is in Webster County. Went to school K through 12 in Marshfield. Went to college here. Came back in 2005. Practiced law for a number of years. And then had an opportunity to work in Jefferson City. So my family and I relocated to the Columbia area.
The book. Yeah. What inspired it? And we'll talk about the book itself, because this is like a mystery of sorts, hopefully yet to be solved.
Yet to be. Well, that's kind of an open question of whether it's been solved or not. That's a funny way of putting it, but I'll try to explain that. About 20 years ago, I went to work for Roland Comstock, who was a probate and estate planning lawyer in North Springfield. Mm-hmm. He had been practicing law here since the early 1960s. He was an older guy. He was more renowned, and really renowned worldwide, as a book collector. He collected first edition books.
Okay.
His home, just north of McDaniel Lake, north of Springfield, had a three-story library built onto it. He built it onto it. Dead authors at the top, living authors at the bottom. He collected signatures. He spent $50,000, $60,000 a year on his book collection. He traveled around the world to get these signatures. He was profiled in the Washington Post, profiled in the London Times. He was well known for doing that, in addition to being a really good lawyer.
And in what period of time was that around?
So when I went to work for him, it was 2006.
Okay.
He was kind of, he got a lot of attention initially as the as a book collector in the mid 90s, because that's when the Washington Post came to his house and did a whole article about him and his collection. So I think that's when he started getting a lot of attention for it. He was better known in kind of author circles and collector circles and that sort of thing. But he had practiced law here from the early 60s, where he was also a state rep from the north side of Springfield, and got involved with a lot of funny, colorful cases. He represented a bulldog that was going to receive an inheritance from his deceased owners. Butch the Bulldog, that's kind of a notorious story around here. The court appointed him to represent the dog's interests in a lawsuit involving that inheritance. So there's a lot of funny anecdotes about his time as in practice. But he was kind of going through some hard times when I went to work for him. He had just gotten a divorce from his wife of 38 years. They were in a very serious, very contentious battle over the house, over selling it, over who was going to own it. And ultimately, the day after that real estate listing expired on that house, he was found shot dead in his kitchen. That was in July of 2007. July 2nd, 2007 was when he was murdered. And so then there was an investigation. The Greene County Sheriff's Department, because it was outside city limits, investigated it. You know, to be fair to them, there was not a whole lot of evidence for them to work with. There was no gun. There was no DNA. There was her briefcase that had been left in the library. And that was it, really. There were some other things, but we get into that a little bit in the book. There were never any charges brought against anyone. However, and this is where we get into the whether this is a solved case or not, Roland's daughter filed a wrongful death civil suit against her mother for causing his death.
So she clearly believed.
She clearly believed, and clearly believed there was evidence for that. And she hired the firm I went to go work for after I worked for Roland, Hosmer, King, and Royce. A lot of people will know Craig Hosmer is a city councilman here. Stuart King, who is now no longer practicing, he had a stroke and he's no longer able to talk. He litigated that case and got a civil jury to say Alberta Comstock pulled the trigger and killed him.
And a lot of people know this, especially if they watch Datelines. The threshold for a civil case is different than it is for a criminal case.
That's right. You have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case that there's no other possibility someone else did this. With a civil case, it's a preponderance of an evidence, which is, you know, it's hard to put a number on it, but you want to say like 51% more likely than
right.
not. And so that's not precise. I mean, ultimately, that jury or that judge is going to have to make a judgment call, literally, and they're just going to look at the evidence. They're going to have to weigh the credibility of the people that are testifying, and they're going to have to make that call. But yes, it is easier.
Right.
To prove a civil case. That's for sure.
We are talking with our author of the week, James Owen. The book, The Wicked Among Us, Murder, Blackmail, and Book Collecting in the Ozarks. Did the daughter feel immediately, because of the contentious relationship, I think mom did this? Or was that something that developed over time?
When you look at the people who were cooperative with mm-hmm. with the sheriff's department, there was a belief that it was either the ex-wife, and there was some belief possibly it was a son that could have been involved mm-hmm. as well, Michael Comstock, who there was, I mean, other than some DNA that was found on a cigarette butt that was found on the property, there was really no evidence that tied him to the property either. I just want to make that clear. but there were a lot of people who came forward to say, oh yeah, Michael Comstock said he was involved with this, he did that. However, a lot of those people were trying to get plea deals on their criminal cases, and so they were not found to be very credible as far as witnesses. So yeah, so I think there was a question of whether or not it was the ex-wife or could have been this son.
Now, how did, if at all, the ex-wife and or the son benefit from his death?
Alberta, the ex-wife, did talk to people who believed that if something happened to Roland, if he had died, that she would get the house.
Okay.
Which, by the way, is not how that was going to work out. the house was owned by a trust. It was going to be going to people who were going to benefit from the trust. But she was supposed to receive some money from some lawsuit settlements. And so I think it was her belief that she would have gotten the house had something happened to him.
So it was the argument or the belief that that's why it happened a day after the listing expired, that in her thinking somehow that would result in her receiving the home as opposed to while it was still listed?
I think the house became a symbol for her anger and hatred towards her ex-husband. I mean, and you know, like anybody who's involved with, talk to Kyle Wyatt about divorces and
You're
family
right.
law, there are people who, there's an irrationality there. There's a frustration there. There's
sure,
this belief
sure.
that their whole life was a lie because they were in this sham of a marriage or whatever you want to call it. I think that house became a symbol for her.
Okay.
I think she was fighting for that house because she believed it was going to somehow vindicate this whole 38 years she had been married to Roland. And then when that house listing expired, it was also the same day that she ended up firing some of her lawyers from some of the lawsuits that were involved with her ex-husband. I just think that there were a number of things that happened on that day that pushed her towards Springfield. She was living in Oklahoma at the time. Mm-hmm. And I believe that pushed her to Oklahoma, where she was either going to confront him or do something. And I don't necessarily know if she got in her car coming to Oklahoma to do this, but I certainly think that she was very angry. And a lot of circumstances had led her there.
We are talking with James Owen. Again, the book is The Wicked Among Us, Murder, Blackmail, and Book Collecting in the Ozarks. You clearly had a close relationship, so this is something that, you know, you had probably an emotional connection to. When this first occurred, did you have a sense of what may have happened, given your knowledge of relationships, or is that something that developed as you wrote the story and gathered additional information that you maybe didn't have before?
When I originally found out about it, I got a call from one of our mutual clients, and I just assumed he had had some sort of heart attack, and he was 70 years old.
Okay.
He was diabetic, he had heart disease, had polyps in his lungs. He had all sorts of health problems. I just assumed that's what happened. But then I was talking to somebody else, a news reporter who I was friends with in Springfield, who said, you know, they're investigating a homicide, and I think it's your old boss. And my immediate thought was, as I think anybody who, you know, is kind of involved with the law and kind of involved with any kind of disputes like this, your immediate thought goes to someone who knew
the victim. Sure.
And I think that you see that happen a lot. Yeah. And I also, because I think this is another quirky twist to this, Nick, is he lived in a house that was surrounded by wolves. He had pet wolves. Okay, so
not common.
Not common. And not animals that are going to just sit there and let a random person come into your house.
Got it.
So my immediate thought was, if anybody had went into that house, a stranger, there was speculation it was somebody he met on the internet, which is a whole other element of the story, but I'll get into that if you want to, that he had let a stranger in or a stranger had broken in to rob him and they had killed him. However, with those wolves there, I just do not believe they would have let a stranger in that house. Everybody who went into that house, even people who were there a lot, his paralegal, Becky Frakes, mm-hmm. who is prominent in the book, his daughter, Faith Stalker, who he was very close with, they were scared of those wolves. The only person who was never really scared of them and they knew was Alberta. Mm-hmm. So it just, to me, the presence of those animals and the fact you have these huge gates around this house, 8 feet in the air, 3 feet in the ground, so no neighbor dogs could dig in, because that used to be a problem. Neighbor dogs would get in there and they wouldn't come out.
Were these wolves in the house?
They would. They had free reign of the whole property.
Why?
He loved them. He was their den father. He was the guy in charge. He was their...
that. I know this by no means is the point or a major theme of the story, but I just, was that an accidental thing for him that became something like, oh, I found some wolves, or did he have some interest and set out to have wolves?
It was initially Alberta's idea. She loved wolves. She had kind of this, like, I don't know, like, she's from Oklahoma. I think there might have been some sort of, like, kind of mystical thing for
sure,
her.
Okay, sure, sure, sure.
He kind of wanted to give her something to, a project to work on. So they adopted these mixed wolves, which they had to adopt the whole pack because you can't just adopt one of them. And so they were there, and I think ultimately they got crossways with the Missouri Department of Conservation, who were saying, you can't have these. It became kind of a legal cause for Roland, and I believe that kind of bonded him to those animals, was fighting for them to stay there.
He had a lot going on.
He was an interesting guy, Nick. So, I mean, somebody should have, I mean, that was what people kept telling me. Somebody should write a book about this guy. So that's what I did.
When, how much of the book was knowledge that you already had? I mean, was this, oh, I've got it right here, or was a portion of the book after you decided, this is an interesting story, I want to write about it, and then there was a lot of discovery after you decided to write the book?
Certainly, I knew everyone involved. Mm-hmm. I knew a lot of the feelings and attitudes about it. I mean, that was a good foundation. But knowing details about his life, knowing details about his family, knowing details about the investigation, I had to learn all of that. And that took a long time to do. I was working full-time, got married, had kids, moved, did all of these things while I was kind of working on this. And, you know, it required a lot of talking to people who knew him, reading his letters, reading his scrapbooks, talking to county clerks about trying to get files from like the 1960s on some of these cases he worked on, ordering the transcripts for the civil trial, which, by the way, is not cheap. So I really did try to do as much as I could to, you know, do this from an objective perspective. I don't really mention myself at all in the book. So I tried to make this a book that people would kind of be able to look at it cold, and it's not necessarily got personal elements to it. I tried to make it as direct of a story as I could.
Was there anything that you discovered that made you at some point go, huh, maybe I got this wrong?
I certainly think that during the period of investigating, I know that there was a lot of criticism of the Greene County Sheriff Department. And I'll confess, I don't shy away from that criticism in the book. However, in talking to people and looking at what they had to work with, it was very clear they did not have a lot of evidence. And so I think that while you could question whether or not they should have been looking at different people, going down different leads, you also have to recognize they are professionals who were making judgment calls based on what they believe the evidence was taking them to. And so, you know, you can understand where the sheriff's department and the prosecutor's office had a dilemma on their hands. They had a high profile case that didn't really have a lot that they could take in front of a jury to prove that very significant burden they have to imprison somebody for causing this death. And so, I mean, I think I became much more sympathetic to that point of view as I was researching it.
Sure. Any final thoughts or takeaways that you'd like for the readers who pick up your book, and we'll talk about that here in a moment, that you'd like them to walk away with?
One of the things that I tried to do very consciously with this book was make this about Roland. I know it's going to be a draw for people to read about a local crime, about these local individuals, about the trial. I mean, I know there's a lot of drama that's associated with that. There's probably a part of my thinking that Roland is probably looking down on this and thinking this is a real kick that someone has written a book about him. He was a very dramatic guy in that regards. But I also think it's important to not lose track of him. I think a lot of true crime books, certainly when I was trying to teach myself how to write in this genre, which I didn't really know much about, they focus on the killer. They focus on suspects. They don't necessarily focus on the person who died. My hope is that people will read this book, learn about him, learn about who I think is a very colorful character that lived here in Springfield, practiced law here in the Ozarks, and that they will not forget him, because I do think he is just one of a kind.
Sounds like if there were a few more characters thrown in for purposes of artistic liberty, you could have one of these Knives Out films.
Yeah,
with
you
the
could
wolves
have,
and the, you know, it just seems like you got some colorful storylines woven in.
It is. There are points. I've actually explained this book to people and they're like, this is nonfiction.
Yeah.
And I mean, and so like that to me, I think has been good as a writer, because there's very little I could screw up. I just had to be very straightforward in telling the story. And I think it speaks for itself. And so I just hope if I reported it fairly and reported it accurately, that people will not only enjoy this book, but maybe learn a little bit about the criminal justice process, learn a little bit about what it's like to be a lawyer, and learn a little bit about Roland. That's my hope.
The book, which again is The Wicked Among Us, Murder, Blackmail, and the Book Collecting in the Ozarks, the 20th available?
Available correct? January 20th. You can pre-order anytime before that. We will be doing, like I said, ABC Books on January 31st. And so we're very excited about some of the events that we have lined up in Springfield to talk about this.
James Owen, appreciate you coming in the studio. I know you've been traveling around quite a bit, so it's good for you to stop by.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you.
You bet. As always, Springfield's Talk 104.1. I'm Nick Reed.